This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a discussion about Pakistan. Our guest is journalist Mary Ann Weaver. As a foreign correspondent for The New Yorker, she began reporting on Pakistan in the early 1980s when she was based in New Delhi for the magazine. Weaver says at the end of that decade, Pakistan had been transformed into one of the most frightening places on earth. Weaver says of Pakistan today, quote, "The accumulation of disorder in Pakistan is such that it could well be the next Yugoslavia." Mary Ann Weaver has interviewed many of the key players in Pakistan, including General Pervez Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto. She is the author of Pakistan in the Shadow of Jihad and Afghanistan. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Mary Ann Weaver is also the author of A Portrait of Egypt. In addition to the years she spent working in New Delhi, Weaver has also been based in Cairo, Athens, and Bangkok. Listeners, I invite your questions for Mary Ann Weaver. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Mary Ann Weaver, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
Sure. There were elections last month in Pakistan, and today a coalition government is taking shape, reportedly. There's this report from the AP. Hardline Islamic parties in a pro-democracy bloc in Pakistan agreed to join forces Tuesday, giving them the parliamentary majority needed to form a coalition government and possibly choose a pro-Taliban cleric as prime minister. What's the significance of the formation of this government?
I think it's extraordinarily significant. The religious parties, there are six of them actually, which comprise a group called the MMA. They have been bargaining and jostling with the secular democratic opposition and with General Musharraf since the elections were held on the 10th of October. They control nearly 25% of the seats in parliament. They will control the provincial governments in Balochistan and the Northwest Frontier Province, Pakistan's two most strategic and sensitive provinces bordering Afghanistan. And yes, as you said, all six of these parties were very close to the Taliban. After the elections, the first thing they did was to pledge allegiance, continuing allegiance to the Taliban. And again, going back to the two provinces they will control, above and beyond their influence at the center, in both the Northwest Frontier Province and Balochistan, there are large numbers of former Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters, according to Pakistani intelligence sources, perhaps as many as 5,000 of them. This will certainly complicate the American war on terrorism. Mm.
And what can you tell us about the man who may become the next prime minister, a man by the name of Fazlur Rahman?
Well, the Mulana Fazlur Rahman, who is fairly prominent in my book, is a Sunni cleric. He is a graduate of El-Azhar University in Cairo. He is not from the madrasas, the Islamic religious schools in Pakistan. His base of support is primarily in Balochistan in the Northwest Frontier Province, but he also played the Pashtun ethnic card in these elections and captured seats in the capital Islamabad, Karachi, and also Lahore. He is a man who is, over the years, he has been variously said to be funded by Saudi Arabia and or Iran. He prospered during the jihad in Afghanistan, the American-led war of the 1980s, and he actually was in coalition with Benazir Bhutto and the Pakistan People's Party during Bhutto's second term as prime minister. So forming an accommodation with the secular liberal movement in Pakistan is not new to the Mulana.
Yeah, it's very this is very interesting to me that there is this there are these connections, these entanglements between the secular world in Pakistan and the religious world.
Mm-hmm.
What is in Musharraf? What is his situation at present? Where how is he? What is his position in the wake of these developments?
Well, I think that probably no one was more shocked by the outcome of these elections than Parviz Musharraf was. The elections were very, very restricted and controlled. Even well before they were held in April of this year, Musharraf held a referendum to extend his term of office by 5 years. He subsequently amended the Constitution with a series of 29 very controversial amendments, which gave him the right to dismiss the parliament that will be sworn in by the end of this week. He set up a military-dominated National Security Council, which will be the final arbiter of the country's affairs. Everyone to whom I spoke in Pakistan on the eve of the election told me that the government appeared extremely confident that all of its pre-election maneuvers would produce the parliament it wanted. In fact, precisely the opposite mm-hmm. happened. Of the four major parties in the new parliament, three of the four are solidly against Musharraf.
So he must be reeling at this point.
I would imagine he is, because one of the ironies is that his own military intelligence organization, the ISI, an exceedingly powerful group, probably one of the most powerful intelligence agencies on earth, did assist the MMA, the Religious Alliance, in certain constituencies, feeling that it would be pliable and malleable, and that it also could be used as a pinprick vis-a-vis the United States, and Musharraf could say, listen, I've got to back away from this war on terrorism because, you see, the Mulvis and the Mulanas have come to power. But they came to power on a much, much larger scale than anyone, including Musharraf, anticipated.
Are his days numbered?
Well, I don't know. That's very difficult to say. He is a gambler. He is going to have to live with the parliament of his creation. The main question really is, how is the army, especially the 9 corps commanders, how will they react to this? Of the 9, 3 are considered to be very hardline Islamic fundamentalists. 3 are old-style British aristocratic secularists. And the other 3 are fence-sitting at the moment.
This power that Musharraf gave himself to dismiss Parliament, it would seem to me he would be now very unlikely to use that power. Is that correct?
Well, most pundits say that since these were elections which he had so carefully crafted and orchestrated, he would even further diminish his legitimacy if he dismissed the parliament immediately. That being said, no elected government in Pakistan in its 55-year history has ever served a full term. The betting at the moment in Islamabad is that Musharraf could very well, within 18 months or 2 years, depending upon how things go, dismiss this parliament.
You mentioned the core commanders in the military, 9 of them, 3 of them hardliners. Mm-hmm. Is that likely, the military, will we see another military ruler come to power? I mean, who's waiting in the wings?
All right, the people waiting in the wings are those who would be in a position to succeed Musharraf if Musharraf was asked to step aside or if he was assassinated. The most likely contenders are far more militant and Islamist and hardline vis-a-vis India and the ongoing dispute over Kashmir than Musharraf is. Towards the end of my book, I quote General Anthony Zinni, the former commander-in-chief of the Central Command, who is one of Musharraf's closest American friends. He is now, as you know, the peace envoy, the Bush administration's peace envoy to the Middle East. And he said to me, it's so important that we work with Musharraf, not so much because of what Musharraf is or is not, but because what would come after him would be a disaster.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Pakistan. Our guest journalist, Mary Ann Weaver. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number to call in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, what do you think about what Zinni said?
Well, just looking at the configuration, I mean, everyone says if Musharraf fails in putting Pakistan back on track, the three most logical scenarios, none of which are particularly pleasant or appealing, would be that another military man would take over, would probably be a hardline Islamist himself, or the religious hardliners, people like the Mulana Fazli Rahman, would take over, and we would see a religious theocracy like Iran, or Pakistan would simply be faced with chaos and fall apart. One thing that I fault Musharraf for very much is that unlike the three previous military leaders of Pakistan, Musharraf has not, in 3 years in power, ever reached out to the establishment political parties. He relies upon a very small coterie of advisors, largely military men, largely ISI men, and he has not really tried to reach any kind of an accommodation with the established political class in Pakistan.
And how strong is that established political class?
Well, Pakistan has not really had a lot of luck with democratically elected governments. Over the last quarter of a century, there have been only two elected prime ministers, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, both of whom were ultimately dismissed, brought to trial on charges of corruption. But they still command, as these elections show, a lot of support, especially Benazir. Nawaz did relatively poorly in these elections, but Benazir Bhutto, of 272 elected seats, Benazir's People's Party captured 64, whereas the pro-Musharraf party, the so-called King's Party, captured only 77. And as far as the popular vote was concerned, rather like Florida here in the States, Benazir got the largest percentage of the popular vote.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us this afternoon. A caller on line 4 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm interested in how what you're saying about the changes in the new power of the various Islamist parties, how does that fare for the future vis-a-vis India, both in terms of Kashmir and in terms of the atomic weapons showdown between India and Pakistan? And I'll take the answer on the air, off the air, so I'll get off. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. You know, I don't think it bodes well vis-a-vis relations with India, Kashmir, and also the nuclear precipice on which Pakistan and India have been straddling for over a year now. Unlike the Turkish elections, for example, where we have seen very moderate Turkish Islamists whose primary campaign platform was to enter the European Union, the Islamists in Pakistan are basically very, very hardline toward India, especially over Kashmir. There are scores of military training camps scattered across Pakistan run by the religious parties who train young men to go off and fight in what they call the jihad in Kashmir. When Musharraf turned against the Taliban and very guardedly toward Washington last October. The religious parties were in the forefront of the street protests and of the collective rage against Musharraf. They have also more recently accused him of backing down on Kashmir, of abandoning the cause of jihad in Kashmir. I think this call is going to be resurrected.
It sounds like he's a very isolated man at this point.
He is, and as I said before, Celeste, the tragedy is when Musharraf seized power in October of 1999, he was largely supported by everyone across the political spectrum. Nawaz Sharif, who Musharraf overthrew in October of 1999, had basically turned himself into a democratic dictator. People welcomed Musharraf's coming to power. They saw Musharraf as new blood, a new force, someone who did have a vision for Pakistan. But as I said earlier, he could have tapped so much credibility. He could have tapped technical expertise. He could have brought thinkers into his government, and he simply has not. It's very tragic.
You have interviewed him. What is he like?
Well, you know, one of his former commanding officers said to me before I interviewed him the first time, Musharraf is a chameleon. He can be anything. He is very gracious, very charming at once. On the other hand, he can be temperamental. He has been very hardline with me on India. He was certainly exceedingly hardline on Pakistan's support of the Taliban prior to September the 11th. He is disdainful of the country's politicians, which is obviously why he has not made any overtures to them. But he is also the last of the Western-trained aristocrats from the Pakistani army, the generation that went to Sandhurst, that came to Fort Bragg, the Carlisle Military Academy. He is a secularist. He looks to Kemal Ataturk, the founder of modern secular Turkey, as his role model. But either because of Kashmir or of the jihadis or of his own military constituency, or more likely than not, a combination of all three, he has consistently backed down to the Islamists.
You ask early in the book, you wonder, is he not a soldier's soldier, not a patriot, but one of the children of Zia? Meaning a descendant of Muhammad Zia al-Haq, who was killed in an air crash in 1988. Talk with us about that idea of his being one of the children of Zia.
Well, you know, Musharraf is of that generation. He's now in his mid-50s. The generation of army officers who were then majors and captains when Zia was giving absolute stolid support to the U.S. jihad against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Musharraf never participated in that war, neither as a trainer, nor a logistics person, nor a strategist. But that being said, he came of age during those years, and he seems to be increasingly fashioning himself on Zia al-Haq. The elections that he held last month were really a chapter out of the book of Zia, who held equally restricted polls in 1985. But under Zia's tenure, the polls, of course, came out the way he had hoped that they would. This did not happen with Musharraf. But you have basically, Zia and Musharraf are both products of the partition of British India. Both of them are Muhajirs, as the refugees from India who migrated to Pakistan at the time of Pakistan's creation are called. And in my book, one of the most telling examples he gave me of the way in which he personally was affected by partition. Now, partition was in 1947. Over 1 million people were slaughtered as Hindus moved out of what was to become Pakistan and Muslims moved into it. And Musharraf was only 4 years old, and he and his parents and two brothers were on the last train to leave New Delhi for Karachi. And, you know, to listen to a man now in his mid-50s say that he remembered the fear, he remembered the blood, he remembered his father in particular holding this little metal box in his hands, that his father was a diplomat with the Indian Colonial Foreign Service, and his father was given Pakistan's share of the British Empire's Foreign Office funds to take to Pakistan with him. And he said, I remember this tiny little box, and he kept saying it in an extremely nostalgic way, that my father would sleep with his head on it, and when he was awake, he would sit on it.
And what was in the box?
It was the share, the Pakistani share of Foreign Office funds.
Mm. Musharraf's father was a leftist. He came from a family of civil servants and socialists.
Mm-hmm.
What shaped the son's politics? What shaped the general's politics?
Well, I think that as opposed to his two brothers, one of whom is a doctor in Chicago, as a matter of fact, the other is with the United Nations in Rome, Musharraf was the only one who entered the military, and his family was very secular. His mother, who lives with him now, has only recently retired from the United Nations. His parents were products of Aligarh University, the Cambridge of the East. So Musharraf comes with this very westernized, mm-hmm. very secular family legacy. But he also joined an army which, over recent years, especially since the 1980s, has become increasingly anti-American and fundamentalist.
Yeah. It's interesting to me to learn that he not only has Western ways, but you point out he's quite fond of dogs.
Yes, he is.
And you know, I wonder, prior to October 2001, what the Islamists thought of this man.
Well, when Musharraf first seized power in October of 1999, he was obviously rather badly advised, because one of the first photo opportunities which he gave to the Pakistani press was of, you know, a very kind of bucolic family scene in his garden, and he was holding his two pet Pekingese dogs. And dogs, of course, are considered impure in Islam, and the mullahs were just absolutely traumatized. There was a huge uproar over this, and of course, we have not seen Musharraf's dogs since then.
I hope they're okay.
I presume they are.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine they're just under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
Post-election in Pakistan, there are concerns that the Taliban are reorganizing there in preparation for a new wave of attacks on Afghanistan. And from what you've said, that seems to be very, very likely.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back in history and talk about Pakistan and how it came to be entangled with the Taliban.
Well, you know, when the American war or jihad against the Soviet Union was finished with the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989, the Americans really walked away. They walked away from Pakistan. They walked away from Afghanistan. The warlords and tribal chiefs whom we, the U.S. government, had supported in the war against the Soviets then became involved in an absolutely lethal, fratricidal bloodbath, killing each other. Some 10,000 Afghan civilians were killed in the process. Then in 1994, a chap by the name of Mullah Muhammad Omar, a fighter in the war in Afghanistan, based in the former rural capital of Kandahar. I went with a group of men to rescue some boys and girls who had been kidnapped by these tribal lords and were being very badly mistreated, including being raped. And Mullah Omar and his talibs, as they are called, students of Islam, were hailed in Kandahar. And at this point, Benazir Bhutto was in power in Pakistan. It was her second prime ministership. And she and her then Minister of the Interior, a retired general by the name of Nasrullah Barber, they looked to the Taliban as a force that could bring stability to Afghanistan. And ironically, at that time, Benazir Bhutto's little-known chief of military operations was none other than Parviz Musharraf. So it was Benazir and General Barber and General Musharraf who really threw Pakistan's support behind the Taliban and were absolutely instrumental in the Taliban's rise to power in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Had it not been for Pakistan, vis-a-vis logistical support, military support, economic support, the Taliban probably never would have managed to get out of Kandahar, sweep across the country, pay off tribal chiefs, and ultimately capture the capital, Kabul.
Hmm. And to what extent does American foreign policy shoulder some responsibility here? I mean, you mentioned earlier we walked away.
Oh, I think we shoulder a huge amount of responsibility for this. I mean, when I first went to Pakistan in 1982, exactly 20 years ago, the jihad was underway. Pakistan was then, as it is now, the key staging area for Washington's Afghan War. Then it was the battle against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan on the last battlefield of the Cold War. The United States government invested $3 billion in this fratricidal alliance of seven Afghan Mujahideen groups, none of whose leaders were by nature democratic, and all of whom, to a greater or lesser extent, were fundamentalist in religion, autocratic in politics, and vehemently anti-American in both respects. So Pakistan really became both perpetrator as the key staging area for the jihad, both perpetrator and victim of that war. And today, 20 years later, there is an incredible sense of deja vu.
You've been traveling to Pakistan since 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Share with us your observations about how the country has changed over those 20 years. What does it look like there in Pakistan on the ground?
Well, every time I return to Pakistan, and I was there most recently in January of this year, I'm just always struck by the decay, by the institutional meltdown, by the Islamist as opposed to Islamic fervor that has increased palpably in the last 20 years. There are now some 12 to 15 private Islamist armies in Pakistan. There are 40,000 madrasas or Islamic religious schools, many of which teach only jihad. I mean, they are Quranic schools. They teach the Quran. They teach the Hadith, the Sunnah, and also jihad. Fazlur Rahman, the Mulana, during the years of the jihad, he himself and his Jamati Ulama-e-Islam, which is the Islamist party he has, he set up 7,000 madrasas in the province of Balochistan alone. And so it's just this increasing Islamism, this increasing militancy, which has gone hand in hand with faulty governments, corruption, an institutional meltdown, which breaks my heart because I want to make it very clear. I mean, I love Pakistan. I have very, very dear, compassionate Pakistani friends. And they're, you know, they've always sent their children abroad to be educated. The difference between now and the first time I went to Pakistan in the 1980s is that they are sending their kids abroad to be educated and saying,
don't come back.
And that means you are having an incredible brain drain, and you're losing a huge part of a future generation for Pakistan.
Well, to think of this country as the next Yugoslavia is truly frightening.
It is.
In large part because the nation has nuclear weapons.
Precisely. 30 to 50, it has the same kind of institutional meltdown that Yugoslavia did. The Punjabis are basically the Serbs of Pakistan. I mean, they are preeminent in the military, in the civil service, and according to the Pathans from the Northwest Frontier Province, the Sindhis from Sindh, the Baluchis from Baluchistan, the Punjabis are dominating them in an extraordinarily imperial fashion.
Both India and Pakistan showed the world they had nuclear weapons when they conducted tests in 1998. How was Pakistan able to build a bomb?
Well, I remember when I was during my earlier period in Pakistan, and I can't remember if it was 1984 or 1985, a group of Pakistanis were arrested at, I think it was Cincinnati Airport, with very innocuous, what are called dual-use devices, that Zia Haq explained to me. This was Pakistan's penultimate military leader. I remember he sat me down and drew a diagram, which I actually still have to this day, and said, these are simply lights to put on top of ambulances. Well, of course, they were dual-use. And the International Atomic Energy Agency ultimately said, you know, these were part of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal. Well, part of the parts to build a nuclear arsenal. And the Pakistanis really, I mean, they had incredible help from China. They had help from North Korea. But they also, they begged and they borrowed and they stole. They literally built a nuclear capability from scratch, piece by piece, bit by bit. And they now have an estimated 30 to 50 nuclear weapons.
And at that time, back when they were working on this, did Washington know? Was Washington concerned?
Well, Washington knew, and Washington was very concerned until December of 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And then all nuclear concerns were set aside. President Carter did briefly cut off military aid just before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. But subsequent to the invasion and the launching of the jihad, every American administration turned a blind eye to Pakistan's nuclear program until 1990, less than a year after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, when we clamped economic and military sanctions on Pakistan, when the first President Bush said that he could no longer certify that Pakistan was not developing a nuclear device.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. I want to get to this caller here in just a moment. But before we do, I want to ask you, which state is more dangerous, Iraq or Pakistan?
Oh, I think Pakistan. I think Pakistan because Pakistan, number one, has nuclear capability. Pakistan, number two, has none of the institutional capability that Iraq does. Pakistan, number three, with nuclear capability, has consistently refused to rule out a first strike scenario. So everything that we, i.e., the President administration, is saying could happen in Iraq, a month from now or 2 years from now or 10 years from now. It's already happening in Pakistan.
Let's talk now with this listener on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Oh, I'm going to have to be the crank caller here because I supported the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan after having seen the photographs from Pakistan of the beheaded school teachers that the Taliban, it wasn't the Taliban at the time, they were just slaughtering any intellectual, just piles of heads. I mean, it looked like Cambodia, you know. But the other point that I really wanted to raise here, because you have such an interesting perspective on this, is the Dhaka connection and the history of the Bhutto family, which you actually have done remarkably well presenting. Just exactly, you know, I mean, Benazir Bhutto's status is pretty much like Aung San Suu in Burma, you know, and since they're old friends, why doesn't he let her back? So there's two questions here, and I'm not going to engage you. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Let me address the last part of the question first. When you say, since they're old friends, you're obviously referring to Musharraf and Benazir. And Musharraf, I mean, we're talking about two extremely dominating forces here. Two people, she, a feisty aristocrat from Sindh, who has dynastically inherited power. He, an increasingly self-absorbed Muhajir general who migrated from India. Benazir and Musharraf, prior to today's development, were involved in very lengthy negotiations, not the two of them, but through designated principals on both sides. And about 10 days ago, it looked as though there was, in fact, a deal that Benazir would form a government with Musharraf, that the prime minister would be her candidate of choice, that 3 months after this government was sworn in, Benazir's husband, Asif Ali Zardari, who has been in a prison in Pakistan now for 6 years, facing not only charges on which he has been convicted of corruption, but also having been charged with masterminding the murder of Benazir's brother, Mir Murtaza. One of the conditions was that 3 months after the new Musharraf-Benazir government was sworn in, Asif would be released from prison, and Asif and Musharraf and the Prime Minister of Pakistan would meet Benazir at Karachi Airport for a triumphant return. Musharraf was not willing to go that far.
And as for the caller's comments about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, you know, I think that historians for the coming decades will debate the kind of Dostoevskian aspects of the jihad in Afghanistan. This was the last battle of the Cold War. We were standing up to the Soviet Union. By so doing, however, one of the unintended consequences was that we gave nurture, encouragement, arms, and training to those very people who now comprise the most militant of the militant Islamists. Osama bin Laden came of age in Afghanistan. Ayman Zawahiri, his designated heir, came of age in Afghanistan. And this is one of the ironies of today's militant Islamist movement, whether it's in Pakistan or Egypt or Saudi Arabia. The vast majority of its leaders were funded, armed, and trained in Afghanistan by the United States.
Before we run out of time, let us talk a little bit about Kashmir. It is so critical. Pakistan came very close to using nuclear weapons in 1999.
Exactly. Kashmir.
Over Kashmir. How was that calamity averted? And then the follow-up question would be, where do we stand today? And are there any bright spots in terms of a settlement over this disputed territory?
Well, you know, so many people have said to me that the Israeli-Palestinian dispute is simple compared to the Kashmir dispute. Kashmir has now been going on for 55 years. It is divided, it is disputed between India and Pakistan. It is a legacy of partition. Both India's identity as a multi-ethnic secular state and Pakistan's identity as a homeland for the subcontinent's Muslims are tied into Kashmir. Neither India nor Pakistan can win Kashmir militarily. But because it is so crucial to their individual identities, neither can lose Kashmir politically. We are now saying, vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein and the UN Security Council, look at all of these resolutions with which Saddam has never complied. Well, there are dozens of UN resolutions passed largely in 1948 and 1949 calling for a referendum, a plebiscite in Kashmir in which the Kashmiris themselves will vote and decide whether they want to be part of India or of Pakistan. These plebiscites have never been held. And the, you know, part of the irony of this is that now, increasingly, the Kashmiris are so fed up with Indian repression on the one hand and Pakistani Islamic militancy on the other hand, they want to be a part of neither India nor Pakistan. Every time I go to Kashmir, the talk is the same. We want to be independent. We always have. So I would say let the United States, number one, become involved because we are the world's only remaining superpower. Let us get India and Pakistan and the United Nations around a table and let's resolve Kashmir, because until Kashmir is resolved, the border between India and Pakistan, known as the line of control, will continue to be what President Clinton said it was 2 years ago, the most dangerous place on earth.
Hmm. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Very important topic, and I hope our listeners have benefited from the discussion this afternoon. Marianne Weaver, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Celeste, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Marianne Weaver, foreign correspondent for The New Yorker. She began reporting on Pakistan in the early 1980s when she was based in New Delhi for the magazine. She is the author of Pakistan in the Shadow of Jihad and Afghanistan. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. She is also the author of A Portrait of Egypt.